Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy, powered by the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation. Lost in all of the discussion around the dispute between the House and the Senate and the governor and school choice, school voucher bills, this what I would color one large school privatization bill, is the impending introduction of managed care to the state of Oklahoma. Now, why should we care about that? So managed care, we talked about this last summer after the passage of a piece of legislation that was supposed to kind of rein in the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority's aspirations and plans to implement managed care, which is a directive of Governor Stitt. Well, we should care because it impacts a million Oklahomans, and it primarily impacts the women and children that are covered under Medicaid, which is the vast majority of that million Oklahomans. I'm, of course, kind of rolling off the 300,000 people who are about to lose their coverage because of the end of the health emergency. But anyways, there's a solid 1 million Oklahomans covered by Medicaid. Now, the reason why we should be concerned is because OHCA has been a phenomenally well-run state agency. It manages its finances well. It is truly, you wouldn't know it for inside the state, but outside of the state is regarded as one of the best programs in the country. But what makes us odd is that we are not a managed care state. 41 states have a managed care program for their Medicaid. And so the vast majority of Medicaid recipients in the United States are under some form of managed care. But this is literally why we should care. It is a multi-billion dollar contract. And so we should be absolutely concerned with how it is awarded and administered. Right. And so what do we know about the Stitt administration? We know that they really don't like to follow purchasing guidelines. We know this. OK, so we have, you know, it's amazing the things that have happened over the course of Oklahoma history, where they have put in statute and in the state constitution a number of measures to combat, push back and prevent corruption and self-dealing in the state government. And we've seen a slight unwinding of that during the Stitt administration that we know of course, right? So despite widespread publicity surrounding all of the skirting of purchasing rules, that's like the most polite way I can describe it, before he Stitt was still reelected. And here we are looking at Medicaid turning to a managed care program, the administration of multi-billion dollar contracts. And there were certain guardrails put in this legislation to kind of keep things in control and to make sure it was a locally run program. So anyways, well, all of this is to say is that may not have been working out the way it was placed in statute, right? So I'm just going to cut to the chase. Today we have a former representative and now a full-time practicing attorney, Colin Walkie, with us to kind of discuss what was going on with this, the lawsuit that was, filed against the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority and Kevin Corbett in regards to the request for proposals, the RFP process that was supposed to kind of dole out this multi-billion, like, big honking contract from the state. So Colin, it's really good to see you today. I mean, not being a legislator seems to be treating you well.
I'm definitely a lot calmer than I have been.
Well, we're about to change that. So so tell us a little bit about what you're doing these days.
Yeah, so with regard to the managed care case in particular, first of all, I think it's important that everybody understand what managed care is and Medicaid and how that all works. So starting at the beginning, everybody knows that we passed state question 802 to expand Medicaid. And what that meant was more individuals, depending on their income levels, could now qualify for state insurance. And so it had nothing to do with managed care. However, Governor Stitt wanted to implement managed care. And so immediately after state question 802 was passed, The healthcare authority went ahead without any legislative authorization and attempted to implement managed care. Now, what does managed care mean? Well, typically when you go to see a doctor under a typical Medicaid scenario, you get what's called a fee for service. You go see your doctor, doctor gets paid $10, right? Under a managed care scenario, you go to see your doctor, the doctor only gets paid, say, $100 per month for you. And so as a result of that, the doctor then, if he wants to refer you out somewhere else, that $100 a month gets split between you and the referral as well, right? So one of the facial problems with managed care is that there is an incentive to not provide care to individuals because that cuts into how much money you get to keep, right? Now, there is also an argument for it, which is, yes, but it incentivizes to not waste medical resources and improve coordination of care between entities, because now everybody's incentivized to make sure we're doing what's absolutely necessary to get these people in better.
And I'll just jump in really quick too, because the problem that the proponents for managed care will say the problem with the fee for service model is that, you know, you get paid, you charge for every test, every little thing that is run to try and figure out what's wrong with somebody. And so it leads to a proliferation of test medications, doctor's visits and stuff, which they see is harder to contain than going by this capitated model where you get one bulk fee and it covers all the costs.
Correct. Correct. And so in 2021, the healthcare authority put out a request for proposals for managed care contracts, and four insurance companies won those contracts. Well, that was then challenged to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court struck it down and said, sorry, folks, the legislature didn't let you do this. And so in 2022, we passed the Ensuring Access to Medicaid Act. Now, here's the key. At that time, all of the providers got together, because what they did not want to have happen is having Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Humana, whomever it may be that is at the top of the pyramid, telling the physicians what to do. So the physicians went, what if we partnered some way, shape, or form with these insurance companies, or were the insurance companies ourselves? We form our own insurance company. And so the bill was written in such a way that it created this new type of entity called a provider-led entity, which is a legal term that's been around for a long time, but never really codified in Oklahoma statutes. And the legislature said, we want Oklahoma companies to take care of Oklahomans. So we want to give preference to provider-led entities, which are entities that are owned by physicians, or they are structured in such a way that they have certain people on their boards so that it would be a provider-led entity. So there's two definitions, one based off of ownership and one based off of structure. The problem with the structure definition is that really you can just put an administrator from New York City that's been dealing with Medicaid on your board, and now you're qualified as a PLE, which is insane, but that's the way they wrote it. The legislation also included bonus points for ownership of a PLE and structure of a PLE and a few other things. All right, so as a result of this, the request for proposal comes down.
The new one,
after the legislation passes, and I represent a group called Equity Group Advancing Access and Services. And that is an organization that's comprised of 16 safety net providers across the state of Oklahoma. And these individuals wanted to be the insurance company and bid on the contract. The problem is that the request for proposal that was written in such a way that if you were a newly formed entity, which you'd have to be if it's a wholly owned PLE, because those are new entities by legal definition, you literally could not respond to some of the questions. For example, one of the very first questions is, please provide 3 years of tax returns. Well, guess what you don't have if you're a new entity? 3 years of tax returns, right? And to make it even more egregious, I mean, they basically copied and pasted the old RFP. They made a few tweaks, but what was really, really egregious is that in the 2021 RFP that was struck down, that one awarded points based off of two questions for, I think it was 50 points. It was 3% of the total points. Well, now in the new RFP, those same exact questions are worth 10% of the points. And the reason why that's important is because one of those two questions asks, have you ever gone through a readiness review? And a readiness review is exactly what happens just prior to the federal government going, you guys can be a Medicaid managed care state and you can be an insurance company for the managed care providers. That means that unless you have ever gone through a managed care contract, which Oklahoma hasn't had since the early 2000s, you can never respond to that question. Not only that, but the RFP says, for the bonus points, it says, we have developed a methodology according to the statute that will afford up to 50 bonus points. Well, okay, that's all well and good, but how are you allocating those 50 bonus points, right? Is it based off of ownership? Is it based off of the criteria the legislature to do? How are you awarding it? We don't know. So we file our lawsuit because at the end of the day, we can't win this bid. So they need to go back and rewrite this so that we can win. And this exact scenario happened in North Carolina. North Carolina went to managed care. North Carolina did PLEs. And up front in their RFP, it says, if you are a newly formed entity, then you may submit information from each of your owners to provide the information. They didn't do that in Oklahoma. So we felt like we needed to go ahead and file a lawsuit to try and get them to rewrite this. And what we found out when they filed the response brief is that they hadn't developed a methodology for the bonus points. They were awarding all 50 bonus points, not up to 50, all 50 bonus points if you were a PLE. Now, here's the problem. Go back to the definition of a PLE, ownership or structure. So now all of the major insurance companies can bid as a PLE. We are always going to lose because we haven't partnered with any of the out-of-state organizations that have experience in this arena. And so it was inherently biased against these newly formed entities. Unfortunately, so typically in a bid, right? So any public bid, OU wants to build something, there's a bid process. Typically in that bid process, if you have to actually submit a bid and then lose in order to challenge the bid in the first place. That's like the standard rule. Well, in this case, we didn't have that opportunity. We couldn't do it for various reasons. And so ultimately, the Supreme Court denied jurisdiction in our case. They didn't rule against us. I mean, effectively, they did because they kicked us out. But they denied jurisdiction. And while they didn't state why, my bet is because we didn't submit a bid. There is case law in other jurisdictions and even kind of in Oklahoma that would argue that we could have still, you know, proceeded forward, but the Supreme Court just simply felt like, well, if you haven't lost, you know, you theoretically could have won, right? I mean, that was their argument was, well, you theoretically could have won. Well, we knew we couldn't. So that was the problem in our case, but there were major problems of this. And so, for example, there were eight bids submitted for all of the managed care contracts. Seven of them were provider-led entities. So if you award bonus points to all provider-led entities, the Oklahoma-owned entities are now competing with Blue Cross, Humana, you know, Centene, all of the big insurance companies without the benefit of actually having bonus points because we're all playing on the same field. So that's kind of the short summation, albeit 10 minutes worth, of where managed care started and where we're at today. The bids are supposed to be let at the end of May. And I would not be surprised if somebody loses a bid and then challenges it on almost the exact same grounds we did, like the bonus points or something along those lines.
So, okay, to try and pull together a few things here. So the group that's behind the lawsuit, none of them submitted bids.
We did not submit a bid, no. And the reason is because to submit a bid in the state of Oklahoma, you have to spend about $5 million. $1.5 million of which has to be on deposit with the Oklahoma Insurance Department to become an HMO, a health maintenance organization. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very expensive process. These are safety net providers. So if we submitted a bid that we knew we were going to lose, we knew we'd be wasting $5 million. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of this pickle that we were in where if maybe things had been different or we had at least a little bit better of a shot, then it would have been the case that we submitted a bid. But in this scenario, it was facially clear that we couldn't win. So it would have been a waste of money. We didn't have a choice but to file it without a bid.
So it appears at this point that there are no safety net providers. that will be.
No, that's not true. There will be safety net providers in different ways. So some of the HMOs will be, for example, an insurance company and some safety net providers, or an insurance company and a hospital. And that will be the HMO. And then within the network, there will obviously still be safety net providers and those sorts of things. But there will be partnerships. Yeah.
Okay. So, because what I noticed, I also noticed that the hospital association filed an amicus in support of OHCA.
Yes. There's two reasons for that, I'm speculating. The first reason is because obviously some of the hospitals, as stated in their brief, intended on partnering and submitting a bid. So that's one reason. But the second reason is because as part of this bill, in order to get the hospitals to buy into it, right? So we got the physician buying into it by going create PLEs so that I can be at the top of the pyramid. Then you've got hospitals going, yeah, but we still don't like managed care because we want to get paid. And so they got a shop fee, and I forget what that stands for. It's a hospital.
It basically helped pay the state share.
That's right. So hospitals
start getting the back end to support to fund the state share, so the state doesn't have to pony up. God, was it $25 million or something like that?
Yes. So they get a bump in how much they get paid. So they get a bump once managed care is implemented. And per the statute, managed care was supposed to be implemented by October 1, 2023. But in the bid process, OHCA kicked that date to April 1 of 2024. And originally that was one of our arguments was, this is bullshit. You can't just change the date without legislative authority. For various incendiary reasons, that ended up not really being a winning argument, not because of anything we knew at the time, but because of things we learned after the fact. But the point is, the other reason why the hospital association was opposed is because if we won and if they relet the bid, then in theory, the start date would have been kicked back even more past beyond April 1, 2024.
So, okay. So kind of so here's the thing, like it still all has to get by the federal government. And that can take so much longer than just 6 months, right? So I'm just like,
I think that at this stage there's been enough communication. They have to submit the waivers to the CMS, etc. But I don't see for two reasons, I don't see a practical problem of it starting. Here's the first reason. If you go back to 2021's managed care contracts that were struck down, between the date of the RFP being issued and the date the contracts were awarded was 100 days. And that program was supposed to be implemented in October 1 of 2022, I believe. Okay. And so in other words, and they had the contract let by end of January of 2022. So roughly 8 months later, they would have gone through and had it ready to go. In this scenario, it's gonna be 200 days between the time they let the contracts or issue the RFP and they award the contracts. And so it'll be the end of May. You still got roughly 8 months to April before the start date. So I imagine it's going to start.
So, but at what point does it get, has CMS already signed off on the whole spiel? Or, I mean, because it still has to hit CMS, right? Like they have to have this in place. And like, we have to have our house in order before we go to CMS. And then CMS will say, okay, yes or no, or here's what you have to fix, right? Like, so, I mean, because CMS could be the real boondoggle I don't know if boondoggle is the right word, but like they could put the brakes on.
They could, but I don't know why they would. And the reason I say that is just look at North Carolina. They're essentially doing the exact same thing that we're doing. So once these entities have gone through the readiness review, I imagine CMS is fairly going to rubber stamp it.
Could you say though that OHCA is not following the spirit of the law, perhaps, with this PLE stuff?
I would say they're not following the letter of the law or the spirit of the law. Yeah, because at the very beginning of the statute, it talks about legislative intent, and it said we want a provider-led entity to be awarded these contracts and for this to be a physician-led effort to the maximum extent possible. What could be more maximal than a wholly owned, Oklahoma-owned PLE? Nothing. Okay. And so there's plenty of language. I mean, and just think about the bonus points. The legislature said, here's three things you got to award bonus points on. they're not awarding bonus points on those three things. Like, it's pretty black and white to me that they're not following the letter. Yeah.
So, because I just my understanding that, you know, CMS watches these things.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and I'm just curious if CMS would sign off on something that they could see being, you know, further litigation. Right. So say they award. So just to make sure I understand. So they choose the winners from this RFP in May. And then it goes to CMS. Well, they choose the winners and someone files a lawsuit.
I think I see where you're going with this, but here's the problem. CMS is not going to care about our Oklahoma statutes. So long as the managed care contracts fall within the CMS rules and regulations, Our state law doesn't matter. They're going to go, that's okay. Your deal. I don't care. Y'all are fitting within the parameters that we're telling you to fit in. Great.
But the state legislature clearly does care, I think. And yes, we saw evidence of that with the veto override of the governor's bill on how OHCA wanted to spend the leftover federal COVID money that it had, right? I mean,
they do.
Legislators are paying attention, and my guess is that they would not be very happy that OHCA is just sort of
skirting the law.
Going whatever the hell direction it wants to go, right?
Right, but I can't tell you how many conversations I had with legislators during this process. And the thing is, the two responses that I got were essentially, one, there's just not a political will to push back on this during session because we put so much effort into it last session. Okay. And so I think that they kind of have this defeatist attitude where it's like, we got bigger fish, we've got education, you know, all of these other things this session that they weren't really willing to stick out their necks and go, this isn't what we talked about. I mean, that's the whole reason I voted for the bill was because I knew provider-led entities, that's going to be the key. That's the reason I voted for it. Yeah.
So really, we can only have one scandal per session. Is that right? Like, we can only have one fight. We cannot walk and chew gum at the same time.
I mean, go back and think about it, though. OHA wouldn't be on our side on this because they don't want to delay it anymore, right? And they're an 800-pound gorilla out there.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that's really the whole thing is, like, all the provider groups have a lot of sway. You know, they really do have so much pull, specifically the health, you know, the hospital association, because they have worked hard to make these things work. You know, so hats off to them for just the work that they've done. But and because I think they all see it as inevitable too, right? You know, it was nothing that they could just keep squashing.
Managed care was coming. We just needed a creative solution that we could all live with.
Right. Yeah. That, you know, it doesn't necessarily answer the concern about providers being told by insurance companies how to treat patients. You know, it doesn't answer all those things, but like if they get paid, it helps things a lot.
Well, this is a good segue, I think, I hope, as one who's much more of a novice on this stuff than you guys are. But as the conversation unfolded, I was thinking, we keep talking about insurance companies, physicians, and hospitals. So how does this thing, particularly as it's rolling out, help people who need healthcare? Mm. Poor people.
Yeah.
Who need healthcare.
You know, I think that giving it the best argument that I can give it, the way that it's going to help individuals on health, you know, on an individualized level, is that we are going to have much improved coordination in care. Mm-hmm. And because part of the reimbursement is premised upon improvements in health outcomes. Therefore, if you're hoarding two things, one, if you're hoarding all the money and not spending it on patients, you're not going to see those improved health outcomes, and you're ultimately going to have to pay back as a result of that failure. The other angle to that is the way the law is written, and I forget the exact percentage, but you have to spend between something like 84 and 88% on patient care. So there's only a maximum amount that you're permitted to retain back, so that you're not incentivized to only pay 75% of claims or whatever it might be. So there is kind of a mandate in there that they're required to pay X percent. So I think the coordination of care is really where this is going to come in at, because you don't have doctors incentivized to do all the work themselves or something along those lines. That's the best spin I can put on it.
So how does this help the Oklahoma taxpayer overall moving to managed care? Because as Marianne pointed out, is a national model for how, I mean.
Well, in Colin, correct me if I go off base here, but you know, the line is, the talking point is that it somehow controls costs this way. So, you know, I think Colin, I think you've helped me kind of understand a little bit better how these capitated costs kind of control the cost, perhaps, you know, where it's a set amount each month versus variations, you know, by fee for service. You have so many tests and that amount can go up. So it's supposed to make costs more predictable while improving outcomes, right? I mean, and this is where I get salty, is because the improving outcomes piece comes from the wraparound, you know, patient care, PCCM piece, where you have people with these complex health issues and they have someone helping through, you know, helping coordinate all the care that they need. And that is not questioned in terms of what it does to help people with their health care.
Go ahead, Marianne.
Sorry. No, go ahead.
No, you hit the nail on the head. You absolutely hit the nail on the head with that. And the reason is because we've all had conversations with physicians. My brother's a PA. One of my dear friends is a physician. And their biggest frustration is I can tell these people, eat an apple, eat a salad, you know, whatever. They go home and order a large pizza. Right. And so until you have those social services built around it, just think about right now in an economic context, what we're talking about going on at the Mid-America Industrial Park, where Panasonic wants another $250 million. What for? Daycare centers, right? Social services in those areas, because that's how you build business. The way you build healthcare is through these wraparound services. That's what's missing in our mental health components, all of those sorts of things. So I absolutely agree with you. I think what we're going to see is exactly what happened. Because remember, Oklahoma had managed care in the mid 90s, and then it turned out to be a failure.
Because it was too expensive.
Yep. I wouldn't be surprised if that happens again, because we're not addressing the core problems, which is the societal aspect that drives these behaviors.
And I think, Colin, to your point, it's not that people are flawed and sucky. It's that we have so many social determinants of health, like food insecurity, housing insecurity, generational poverty, trauma, ACEs scores that are sky high. And we're not addressing any of those issues in order to bring, because there is a direct correlation between high ACE scores and poor health outcomes. So I guess that's an inverse relationship. But I mean, we're not addressing any of those things to help improve health outcomes out of the gate, right? Like, so that, I mean, that's instead, just kind of the afterthought.
Instead, we want to spend $1 billion luring a multinational here to create 3,500 jobs, which is generally what we organically create in Oklahoma every year anyway, without doing that. $1 billion that could be spent on some of these things, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Have y'all ever heard of Peter Zeihan? He wrote the book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning. It's all about depopulation. Highly recommend it. Anyway, recently, I saw this on The Lost Ogle. He apparently subscribes to this guy. And he was talking about how Oklahoma is, you know, really going to be successful in the future. And I won't go into all of that. But one of the points he made was, why are you trying to compete with Texas? You can't compete with Texas. Instead, what you need to realize is that you can be complementary to what are the resources that we can develop here in Oklahoma that can feed the supply chain down to Texas. And I think that's an angle of attack that we need to start thinking about when we talk about economic incentives.
Well, just along those thoughts, like if you think about, if you think about all the ways that, you know, borders really don't exist, right? Especially if you live in Ardmore, if you live in Durant, if you live, right? I mean, just in the sense that there is, if you live on LaFleur County and you're back and forth to Fort Smith, like, I mean, we have these metropolises. We effectively do. North Texas goes straight up, you know, what's that town right on the border? My point is like, you know, we shouldn't look like it at a hard, fast stop.
Right.
At the Texas border, at the Arkansas border, the Kansas border, like these metropolitan areas feed into each other. And I've actually heard someone else talk about that. Like, we should have looked at it as one big economic, you know,
zone.
Yes. Yep. I'm losing my train of thought here, but, you know, and just think, if you thought of that from a healthcare perspective as well too, but anyways, no, I mean,
you're shaking your head though.
You know, Ardmore saw this 25 plus years ago and built a whole economic development strategy. And at the time, I was working for the Dallas Morning News, and I thought, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen. You know, why in the world would you promote Dallas? Their slogan was, Dallas is coming our way. And you know what? They were right. And they leaned into it. And you see, when you drive down I-35 to the Metroplex, you see that they were spot on with that. Mm-hmm. And you see the same thing over in Durant and, you know, in places like that as well. So, yeah, but it should tie into healthcare. Because, absolutely, you know, the fact of the matter is you know, a lot of Okies go to Houston, to MD Anderson, for example, and to different places like, I mean, Baylor Scott and White, I mean, all over, right? Yeah.
And there is, and to that point, Arnold, and I'm gonna butcher these details, but the representative Burns, not Ty Burns, anyway, Trey Caldwell, from Southwestern Oklahoma, Lawton, et cetera, in talking about healthcare, and I don't remember what the exact issue was, but essentially, in order to get to the closest hospital, you would have to drive to Texas, which was 10 miles outside of this healthcare zone or something where we received additional funding. And so this arbitrary geographical boundary prevented us from being able to establish a new hospital in that area for all intents and purposes. And that just makes no sense to me segregating.
Your healthcare providers around this Oklahoma state border are duly certified to receive Oklahoma Medicaid funds as well as their own state. Like, there is no, it's back and forth all the time, right? Like, just because they live here, I mean, there is not this hard, fast boundary border that keeps people, especially over on the east side of the state, where they go into Arkansas all the time for healthcare.
But that's why we also have a lot of exemptions when it comes to college tuition for students who are living in these adjoining states, and the adjoining states do for us as well. I mean, you know,
Arkansas,
if you're an Oklahoma student, you can go to Arkansas at mm-hmm. you know, in state rates.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's a whole other episode.
That's a whole other. My point is it's being done.
Texas students keep the lights on in our higher education institutions, period.
Sure. No question. No question about it. But the point is that it's still being done. It's being done in other realms. It could be done in this realm as well, if you're looking at the totality of the package
that
we're looking at.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Colin, what's our takeaway from this? Like, what do we need to know, like, going forward with this?
Well, I mean, I think realistically going forward, like I said, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a managed care contract challenge after the bids are awarded. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is that I am hopeful and optimistic based off of just my clients, as well as some of these other organizations that I'm aware of that are participating. And they seem to be fairly optimistic that they can make this system work. And so I'm hopeful and optimistic that they can make it work, because I do think it would be economically beneficial. But at the end of the day, I tend to think that it's going to fail miserably, just like it did in the mid-90s, and we'll go back to a fee-for-service model or so. Really, I think we just need to rethink healthcare, and that's going to have to happen at the federal level. We've got to get into some sort of cash pay, real cost-based medicine. We do not exist in that world right now. Everything is driven by insurance. And that is what's driving up the costs. And so if we can get away from that, that's going to be the solution.
I just want to touch base back on what you just said about why it failed the first time they tried managed care, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s. And it was because they had actuary, like they gave, so, okay, to back up further from that, Medicaid, if you do this managed care stuff, you have to have a network, you have to have adequate coverage throughout the state. And so, you know, and then so the people who bid have to be able to say, we can provide coverage in this, you know, in these areas. And back then it was in specific areas. It was like urban at first or rural first or something like that. Well, anyways, but they also have to accept what the agency states is like the actuarial risk, right? And like what the cost is going to be. And they have to be able to say that they can operate at this cost. And so what happened was, is back then, and I can't remember, Colin, if it was the high risk population or if it was the children and kids population, which is actually very cheap, comparatively. Anyways, what happened was, is networks started dropping out because they discovered that it was actually a lot more expensive to cover these areas than they expected. And so they just wouldn't agree to the terms that the state had set forth. And they're like, no, you need to give us more money. And the state was like, yeah, but I can't. And so it completely fell apart because they lost coverage and it just rendered it absolutely inoperable and out of compliance with the federal government. So that's what happened then. So what's interesting too is like, okay, so risk pools, right? Like, so kind of back to your point about states, like if we have a larger risk pool, or if it's just managed really well. I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is you have, okay, so say you have this Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is still, you know, by state lines, but it, you know, could conceivably like be national, like say an actual single payer program is what I'm getting towards here. But, you know, you increase the risk pool, theoretically you drive down the costs, yep. Right?
Yep.
You know, or you have these provider-led entities that can, you know, do the full wraparound costs for their patients and then really control the outcomes that way, right? And control the costs and control the outcomes.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't think either of this is going to happen in Oklahoma.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as we get rid of Obama's death panels, I'm okay.
Well, I mean, what's the other death panel? There's another death panel now, right? So it's just like, oh my God. Yeah. That is such a throwback. Right. But yeah, I mean,
but so who always makes out well in these scenarios, whether it's managed care or fee for service?
Excuse me. It's like an insurance company.
Okay. Well,
So to that point, so just talk about the fee for service model, private insurance, Blue Cross Blue Shield. If you'll recall, in 2016, BCBS sent out notices to all of their insured saying, you're not going to be able to go to Integris anymore because they won't agree to our provider rates. And so I had a meeting with Blue Cross and I sat down with him and I said, here's my problem. How do you expect me to go to Integris, which is in my district, as well as my constituents, and say they won't agree to these lesser rates because we as a nonprofit paid our CEO $16 million last year and lost, I don't remember the exact number, $100 million. So you're rewarding somebody with millions of dollars for losing hundreds of millions of dollars? How is that responsible? And so that's, I mean, when we talk about who makes out on it, the insurance companies do.
I mean, because right now it's Cigna and Integris. You know, and a year ago it was Blue Cross Blue Shield and OU Health, right? And so it's like,
I remember one time having a conversation about this with Doug Cox, you know, the former state representative from the Grand Lake area and an emergency room physician. I said, how are things going up your way at the hospital and everything? He said, oh God, he said, they're building this massive new complex right next door. And he said, it has absolutely nothing to do. Not a single person will receive treatment in that giant facility they're building. It all is pushing paper in the insurance process. And he was just rolling his eyes. And it was like, oh my God, you know, could you have a better illustration of how out of whack this is?
Can I ask them, what are these ambulatory care centers then? Because, you know, like these Mercy little mini hospitals and these Integris mini hospitals outside of kind of their areas, right? I'm like, how the hell are they able to do these now? I mean, this is a whole other discussion, but I'm just like, I mean, it's like, are they just, I don't know if they're trying to get market share or because I'm an employee at OU. We're now covered by Cigna and, but I have a doctor at Integris because I was under Global Health back in the day. And that Integris was in my network. No one in Norman, right? But it's just like, I don't understand it, but I don't know. I'm sorry, but my bottom line is employer-based healthcare is immoral. because you can lose it. That's happened to us twice in the past 4 years. And also, like, why can't we just have single health care, single payer care? But anyways, this is a whole other conversation. So
the one thing I'll say to that comment, because you mentioned market share. What I don't think a lot of people realize is that that used to be you'd go see your doctor down the street, and your doctor down the street had his office. Well, now the model is that hospitals are buying up practices. Mm-hmm. And so they're seeing, so you're getting, now your physician isn't Joe Schmo MD, now it's Joe Schmo MD with Integris or whomever. Yeah. And so that's part of the reason why you're seeing the expansion, because they need places where to put these physicians that they're buying up their practices. So that's part of the issue.
Well, and just the surprise out of network costs, right? Like, say you go have a kid and your anesthesiologist is not in the same network as your OBGYN, even though he's operating, right? This has happened to me, in case you haven't guessed. So anyway, so yeah. All right, Arnold, parting thoughts?
No, I just think we're at the beginning, obviously. I mean, of this entire phase of the process. And, you know, we did a little bit at the beginning, but we didn't talk much about how comfortable the people of Oklahoma ought to be that this governor has so much power in appointing, you know, folks to the OHCA and in the hiring of the executive.
You don't know anything about the agencies that they're leading.
Exactly. So we may, you know, we Okies are not necessarily the healthiest bunch in the land. You know, if we're top 10 in anything, it's in poor health rates, probably. So this could be a really bumpy ride the next few years, couldn't it?
Very much so. Very much
so. I'm sorry, but I just loop this all back to the five agencies that SIT took over in 2019 were the last ones that were not privatized.
Yeah.
And we're seeing the nonsense that comes with trying to convert all of these things that were state run and run fairly well being converted to private interests.
So, well, I gotta say thank you, Marianne and Arnold, for having me on. You know,
always a pleasure.
I don't get invited to much anymore, so I appreciate the change.
We've been waiting to have this conversation with you. So,
like, yeah, I'd apologize before there were a lot of things going on. That made it where I couldn't. Yeah, but I appreciate it.
We got it. Well, thank you so much. We will definitely have you back again.
Not worried. Y'all have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Bye, Colin.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.